It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled against the Biden administration's student loan forgiveness plan. We'll find out what that means for people with student loan debt and for higher education in general. First, a new bill in the state legislature would guarantee a spot at UW-Madison and other state universities for the top 5% of all Wisconsin high school seniors. We have the bill's author on to give the details on how this could change college admissions, and you could join in at 800-642-1234. Should the top students in each school's graduating class have this guaranteed access to UW-Madison and other UW system and technical college schools? How selective should state universities be when picking new undergrads? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Jerry O'Connor is a Republican state assembly representative from the 52nd District in Fond du Lac. Representative O'Connor, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be with you. Thank you, Rob.
I gave a very basic version of what this proposed legislation would do. Could you spell it out for us a little more, please?
Well, let's go back and just understand where the initiative comes from. This isn't one generated by legislators. It's one generated from students, parents, and then school principals, specifically high school or administrators. They find themselves during the admissions time, when students are sending out their applications, and kids that are in the top 5%, kids that worked hard, some had natural abilities, and others like me just found you had to spend more time getting your grades up. But to that extent, they make their applications and find out that they're not accepted in our state university system. Primarily, this deals with UW-Madison as a flagship school, but it can include our other state universities around Wisconsin. And these kids come back sitting down with a principal or administrator saying, what did I do wrong? What could I have done different? Why was I not accepted? And you know what? You can debate that for a long time, but I really just come back to the simplicity of the scholastic review, the academic excellence, and believe that this group should be rewarded for their hard work and for their excellence in the classroom. If you go to the states of California, they are allowing in 10% of the top scholastic students. Texas is allowing 9%. We propose 5%. We're not trying to dictate all facets of admissions to the UW system, but we do believe it's necessary to raise the issue and provide that guarantee to our Wisconsin students.
I don't know how fine-grained this is at this point, but how would schools define their top 5%? Is this grade point or grade point in standardized tests, or do extracurriculars come into it? How do they say these are our top 5% this year?
Perfect question. The 5%, when we were discussing amongst ourselves how to craft this, I did work with our school administrator out of Fond du Lac, and that's the district I represent, Dr. Jeffrey Flagg. And our conclusion was different schools today are using different criteria. So to sit at the state level, and whether it's legislation or it's from DPI, and dictate to every school district what the criteria is, we stepped back and said, it will be up to the boards of the various schools to establish a scholastic criteria that fits their particular goal in educating their students. So that can be any combination of grade point average, SAT, ACT exam. They could have other scholastic requirements that would be factored in. So it is up to the local school district to define those boundaries, make those known to students in advance so, frankly, they knew what the target was, what their goal would be by the time they completed their schooling. So that's not state-controlled, that's locally controlled, and we really believe that's the best place for that to happen.
Talking to Representative Jerry O'Connor, looking at a plan that would say, hey, UW-Madison and other state higher education institutions, you got to take the top 5% of each graduating class from each high school around the state. Okay, some finer points here. How about the homeschoolers, Representative O'Connor?
Well, that was a question I brought up in a very early discussion. And what we looked at there is taking standardized tests such as SAT or ACTs. If they score in the top 5% of all Wisconsin high school students, then they would qualify.
What are your hopes for the state now, not just the individual students and families here? Do you think this could provide benefits for Wisconsin in general?
I think it does provide benefits, and I'm going to reverse the role. I've talked with – I'm on the College and Universities Committee for the State Assembly, and as different hearings we've had, I've talked with chancellors from different universities in Eau Claire and Oshkosh, and they have, frankly, bragging rights of saying, boy, you know, the number of students we bring from out of state – we're able to retain like 70% of that group upon graduation, and they get jobs in Wisconsin and become part of our community. And frankly, I'm thrilled with that. But at the same time, I know that's what other states are saying when our students don't get qualified or accepted into Wisconsin schools. They go to Minnesota, Iowa, Illinois, Indiana, Michigan, Ohio. They get accepted, and upon graduation, there's a 70% chance that's where they're going to remain. So we believe the long-term benefit is starting with taking our best and brightest coming out of high schools, securing their educations here in Wisconsin, and it will significantly increase the likelihood that upon graduation, they will become part of the Wisconsin fabric community and be a contributor long-term. And I think across the board, the state's going to benefit from that.
As you crunch the numbers, is there still going to be room for that student who is maybe, you know, in the top 7% of their class, wants to go to UW-Madison, can make a case for it? Is there still going to be room for in-state students who don't meet this 5% automatic acceptance requirement at a UW-Madison?
Yes, there will be. To give you an example, last year, in 2022, in the fall, the university had over 26,000 freshman students that were admitted into the university. When we're talking about the top 5% of high school graduates, we're talking about somewhere in the range of 3,200 students, give or take 50 students. So it's well within the capacity of the university to accept these. And even when we're saying this, I'll use the number 3,200, there are a number of that 3,200 that have been accepted. This bill really targets the balance of the 5% that were not accepted. And I, from direct testimony or stories from administrators and parents, we're talking about kids. One example, a young man was a three-sport star. He was number three in his scholastics, and he was the leading actor in a play, and he couldn't get accepted into our flagship university. He now goes to Minnesota, and the chances are when he graduates, he'll remain in Minnesota. That's the student that we're targeting, that we want to retain those students here in Wisconsin. But for the university, we want this to be a larger picture. Quite frankly, the Wisconsin taxpayers pick up two-thirds of K-12 education costs, and we pick up billions of dollars of spending for the university system. So to that extent, we believe the taxpayer should have some voice in what the outcome is and who qualifies to go into our schools. Without us putting forth an exaggerated number, it's just a statement we believe this is the right thing to do.
Representative O'Connor, before I let you go, this is still in early days. What is your, at least your hopeful timeline for this idea?
We have had some discussion of having hearings in August and would introduce this legislation in September.
Representative O'Connor, thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. I appreciate the time.
That's Representative Jerry O'Connor, state lawmaker representing the 52nd Assembly District in Fond du Lac. He joined us for a look at his proposal to guarantee a spot at UW-Madison and other state schools to the top 5% of graduating seniors in each high school. Coming up, we'll get more analysis of the possible impact of that change, and you can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. Do you like this idea? Is this something that would have affected you or your kid in that college admissions process? Do you have questions about how the admissions process works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation about college admissions and a bill in the state legislature aimed to be proposed pretty soon. It would guarantee UW access for the top 5% of Wisconsin high school seniors in each high school. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you think of that idea? What would you like to know about how UW admissions works? Join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions, your thoughts, maybe your experiences. That's 800-642-1234. Taylor Odell is an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Taylor, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thanks for the invite, Rob. Happy to be here.
We just heard from Representative O'Connor laying out the case for this change. What kind of impact did you see this potentially having on admissions, especially at UW-Madison?
Well, it'd certainly control who has access to UW-Madison. I think the bill is marketed as, you know, giving more students in the state access to UW universities. But the reality is that institutions like Milwaukee and Green Bay and all the others already accept a majority of their applicants. And so this really is a UW-Madison mm-hmm. bill. And to put this in context, UW-Madison gets over 60,000 applications a year and accept less than 50% who apply. But they accept 60% of those from Wisconsin, 44% of the entering class is from Wisconsin. And there's already a board policy that requires at least 3,600 of UW's incoming class every year to come from the state of Wisconsin. So I don't necessarily see right now that there is a lack of access to UW-Madison for graduates here. It's important to recognize that UW is a number 10 public institution in the United States, right? So it's selective because it admits the best and brightest and brings those students from to the state from across the world. So the top 5% of Wisconsin is very different than the top 5% profile that UW is drawing from, right? So I think the representative mentioned Wisconsin, you know, we might use ACT scores or something to help define this top 5%. Well, Wisconsin's average ACT score is a 19 versus California's, that's a 27. And so UW is in kind of a different market for students, and it has the benefit of the state of bringing those students from across the world, but from across other states here to Wisconsin.
Part of the case, I think, was for predictability, saying, hey, if you meet your school's criteria, you're in, whereas the perception, at least among some of Representative O'Connor's constituents, is it's a black box. We look good on paper. The kid looked good on paper. We don't know why they didn't get through the process. Is there something to be said for a transparent system like that?
Sure. I mean, I think it can be helpful for students and families and administrators to understand what makes a very, you know, an easy application to college. But at the same time, all of these boxes like GPA, ACT score, things like that, as we look across the state of Wisconsin, students who meet all of those boxes look very similar, right? And so having everyone that checks in each of these individual boxes doesn't necessarily always make for a very interesting or diverse incoming class. And I think the rationale for this bill, though, suggests that even if these things were predictable, that the decision for these students is UW-Madison or bust, right? That they're going to come to UW-Madison. If they don't get in, then they're not going to go, you know, to college, or they're going to go to Minnesota or something, right? So it seems like a better avenue than trying to just guarantee admission and control kind of who's admitted to the state flagship is to work to keep more states more students in state by investing in our other institutions, right? So we kind of talked about the California 9% plan. Well, California doesn't have trouble with students leaving because they have such strong institutions across the board, right? Six of the UCs are in the top 10. And so we could work and use state money to build up our other UW system schools so that it's not UW-Madison or bust, it's Wisconsin.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Nan is with us in Madison. Nan, hello.
Hi. So I'm following this conversation, but I wonder why exactly would universities balk at the top 5% idea, and what exactly do universities get out of being exclusive? Thank you.
Nan, thanks for the call. And Taylor, I don't know that UW system or UW-Madison have taken a position on this proposal at this stage, but in general, what do universities, especially the more selective ones, see as pros and cons of this kind of idea?
Sure. And so I'll just also start off by saying that I'm just speaking in my capacity as a researcher and not on behalf of UW or any opinions from UW or the system. But I don't think that institutions are necessarily against having broader ways to bring students into institutions of higher ed. But the reality also is that UW can only support so many students every year, right? So if higher, larger incoming classes are coming in, that means the institution also needs to take in more money to help those students succeed, to give them a quality college experience. And what we've just seen in the legislature is the legislature instead cutting UW's budget, kind of in the same time that we see this proposal for guaranteed admission of additional students that would make this class even larger.
Thanks for that call, Nan, at 800-642-1234. Talk about college admissions with Taylor Odell, assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. Just heard from a state lawmaker about an idea that would say, hey, top 5% of each graduating class in each district around the state, you're automatically in at UW-Madison and other UW system schools. Still time for you to check in on that idea at 800-642-1234. Taylor, you touched on the idea of diverse student bodies. An argument I've seen for this idea, when it's been presented in other states in the past, is, okay, hey, you know, we're racially segregated in some ways in this country. There's class segregation by county, by district. So maybe by saying, hey, everybody, every district is going to get a certain percentage of their students in here, this is a way to increase diversity. What do we know about how that actually works out in practice?
Yeah, theoretically, that does make a ton of sense. And the best evidence we can look at is to Texas, which has probably the most famous plan that just looks like this, right? The Texas top 10% plan. And we're now 26 or so years since they started operating that. And because of the size of, you know, the top 10% in Texas, UT Austin, their flagship, has a special carve out where they only have to admit, you know, the top 6% or something like that. But in reality, nothing really changed in Texas. So there was slightly more urban, slightly more rural students enrolling in Texas colleges, but really no change in race, ethnicity, or other factors that have persisted over time. And I have some colleagues that evaluated the policy, and they kind of concluded that these benefits were likely overstated, right? And they kind of stopped short in terms of like what people were hoping that this would ultimately achieve. And even with this level of predictability, right, like folks in Texas are still upset because maybe you're in the top 7% of your quote unquote really great high school and someone's in the top 5% of their quote unquote really bad high school. And so there are always going to be these differences in, you know, qualifications of applicants over time. And so this 5% rule wouldn't necessarily address everyone's concern.
Another idea I saw in an argument in favor of this kind of idea is it cuts down on the notion of school shopping. So a parent saying, hey, we know this school sends a lot of kids to the selective university. We're going to get our kid into that high school, maybe abandon this one that doesn't do as well. And whether that target school is a public, a charter, or a private, or whatever, maybe that takes fewer resources out of those schools that are losing students in that scenario. Is there enough research to see if that's something that has actually changed under this kind of system?
Yeah, I mean, I think schools are going to respond, schools and institutions as they start recruiting students are going to respond to this in really different ways. I think the reality and the fact that UW-Madison welcomes students from every single county across the state kind of doesn't suggest that we have these such high levels of geographic, you know, segregation, who has access to UW-Madison specifically, or that folks are really making such important decisions on where they're sending their students in hopes that they're ultimately admitted. But yeah, I mean, I think we'll have to see how this plays out, particularly if we're able to follow what it looks like in other states.
Briefly, a huge issue with just a minute or so left, U.S. Supreme Court ended college affirmative action policies, saying, hey, schools, you can't use race as a direct factor in admissions. What are you watching for next as campuses react to that?
Yeah, so this is a very narrow decision. It doesn't say that colleges can't consider race. What it says is that, you know, race has to be used in this very defined way. It kind of says nothing should be prohibited. You know, universities aren't prohibited in considering race. Students can, you know, discuss how it affects their life, whether through discrimination, inspiration, or otherwise. But what we're going to be watching is how lawyers and institutions respond to this and how they ultimately interpret the decision in the impact of their own practices. What I'm concerned about, though, is kind of many states that seem to be putting the cart before the horse here, like Missouri and Kentucky, and I've heard some proposals in Wisconsin, trying to extend this to other things like statewide scholarships for racially minoritized students or things like that, saying that, you know, this ruling applies to those things as well. And so this is a very narrow ruling on admissions. And so we need to figure out what that looks like, I think, before we push forward and try and dismantle some other things.
Taylor, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks very much.
That's Taylor Odle, an assistant professor of educational policy studies at UW-Madison. He joined us for a look at a proposed change to UW admissions that would guarantee a spot at UW-Madison and all of the UW system schools for the top 5% of each Wisconsin high school's graduating class. That's still in the early stages in the state legislature. Coming up after the news, the Supreme Court ruled against President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. We'll find out why and what borrowers should know before payments resume. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, romantic relationships can be expensive, from dating to getting engaged to planning a wedding or starting a family. We'll find out how finances and economic conditions come into conflict with our love lives, and you can share your story. Now, on Friday, the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the Biden administration's plan to forgive up to $20,000 of student loan debt for some people. So the pause on student loan payments is about to end. That could mean trouble for some borrowers. President Biden has vowed to pursue other ways of providing student loan debt relief. Our next guest has been watching this story make its way through the courts. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the court's decision, or do you wish this plan had stayed in effect? Do you have student loans yourself? Were you looking at some level of forgiveness in it? What questions do you have about how all this works? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Nick Hillman is a professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis at UW-Madison. He's also the director of the Student Success through Applied Research Lab. Nick, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for the invitation, Rob.
Remind us what this particular debt forgiveness plan was going to do before it struck down. Who would it affect?
It would have affected almost anybody who has a federal student loan, and that would be about 36 million people in America. And it would forgive about $400 billion of student loans, basically cancel all of that debt for a lot of people. And it would have been done in order to basically restart the student loan system, as you mentioned, is going to be kind of turning back on after being paused for about 3.5 years.
You wrote a piece when this was argued in the court. You stepped away from your education professor hat and became a full-on Supreme Court analyst. What was at stake? What were the arguments here in the challenge to this White House plan?
I learned so much in this process. I learned about how just the processes work. And of course, some of the earlier cases that kind of gave clues about what might be the decision that we learned about last week. And so it was definitely an education of my own, and I hope to share that with others, especially on this call. So, there's one big piece of this that was very interesting to me, and it's called the major questions doctrine. Basically, the long story short of the case was that the conservative justices, who were the majority opinion, they said that this is such a large, significant proposal or potential change that it didn't have the right kind of authority to have been taken place. And so basically they said that the Biden administration didn't have authority to cancel loans. And the dissenting opinion by the more liberal judges said just the opposite. They said the court itself exceeded its authority by overruling the Department of Education's plans. So it's been really fascinating to see. And what's next is just really the big question.
This ruling came down on Friday. President Biden delivered his response to the ruling at the White House that same day.
Our Republican officials say student loan relief is a giveaway to the privileged. You hear that loud now, the privileged. I love their concern for the privileged. But I know who student loan borrowers are in this country. So do all you. The couple putting off having a child until they can find their way to deal with their debt. That's who they are. They're young, putting off buying their first home so they can get out from under student loans. Hope on the horizon, thanks to relief that I planned last year. Today's court decision snatches it away from them. I get it. I get it. I hear this. And I'm concerned about it. But today's decision has closed one path. Now we're going to pursue another. I'm never going to stop fighting for you. We'll use every tool at our disposal to get you the student debt relief you need and reach your dreams. It's good for the economy. It's good for the country. It's going to be good for you.
Before we get to those future plans, Nick, what do we know about who would feel the impact here? The argument that, hey, this is saving money for people who are already doing okay versus President Biden's argument that, no, there's some people who really need this. What do we know about who would be affected by this across the economic spectrum?
Right. There's 43 million people. So 43 million individual lived experiences. So there's just so much variation here and so many ways that debt has affected people. Sometimes you don't even have to have a student loan to have it affect you. You might say, I'm not going to go to college because I don't think I want to take out a loan. I don't want to go into this debt trap, some folks say. And so, it has a lot of different effects on different people. Some people are able to navigate the student loan repayment just fine. In fact, about 1 in 5 borrowers prior to the pause were paying off their loans within 5 years, like paying them off completely. So you have a huge, huge range of who is affected by student loans. And if I had to pick two groups that were most negatively affected by student loan debt, it would be the first surprising group was folks who have relatively small debts, usually less than $10,000, which is still a lot of money. But they had maybe gone to college just for a little while, maybe a semester or a year, but didn't get the degree. And now they have that debt, but they don't really have that return in the labor force. And so maybe surprisingly or counterintuitively, individuals with relatively small debts, because they kind of dabbled in college and it wasn't for them or whatever, or life got in the way, who knows why they didn't finish, they now have to repay those loans. And they often are the ones who are most likely to default on their debts and get behind and delinquent. So that's one group that I think is truly struggling and will continue to even after the pause is lifted. And the other group is how this cuts across other inequalities that we see all across our public lives, where people of color in particular, Black women in particular, are really affected by student loan debt because they consistently are found to be not only most likely to borrow loans in the first place, but labor market discrimination on the back end when it comes to repayment hits especially hard for Black women and communities of color in general. But I would say, student loan debt has some upside. It can help people, and it also has a lot of downside. It can really create a lot of harm.
Talking to Nick Hillman from UW-Madison about student loan debt forgiveness, a White House plan struck down last Friday by the U.S. Supreme Court. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Nick, before we go to our callers, I want to get really practical here. For people who've been watching this, they have some student loan debt. They were eligible prior to Friday to have some of that debt relief. They've been putting off paying their debt. They've had that delay on payments now. What do they need to know?
Three things. First thing is that payments will be due in October. The beginning of October is the schedule here. So you might hear September. That just means the clock is starting. Interest is starting to accrue in September, but those first payments will be due in October. So that's one thing to keep on your radar. Another, and again, I'm not a financial advisor. I'm a researcher, but these are things that I just know from the policy conversations. So that's one. But so October 1st, keep that in mind. But the second one is really important. If you don't know who your student loan servicer is, some of the popular names are Nelnet. You might have heard of Great Lakes, or previously maybe Navient could be. They're not around anymore. But these are the organizations that you actually make the payment to. And then they are basically the middleman who then makes sure that you don't go into default. And so know who your student loan servicer is and that your contact information is all up to date. And then the third one is to really look in to see what is the best repayment option for you? In some cases, people might be eligible for what are called income-driven repayment plans, where their payments could be as low as $0 a month if they qualify. And so just knowing what your options are, your loan servicer is supposed to help you navigate those options. But I would say prepare for that date, contact your servicer, make sure you're updated, got your email information or account, or you know, bank account information in there. And also just think about whether you have another repayment plan, an income-driven repayment plan that might work better for you.
Let's go to our callers now. Lynn is with us in Sister Bay. Lynn, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up, Lynn?
There.
Yep, go for it. You're on the air.
Well, yeah. What is the amount of interest a student will be paying on a $50,000 loan?
Lynn, thanks for the call. Lynn was breaking up there a little bit, but asking about interest on loans and, Nick, how that factors into, you know, was interest collecting during this delay on repayments?
So interest has been at 0% during this whole pause. So interest has been kind of held at bay. And when the pause ends, interest will kick back on. Now, there will be a change coming up in one of the new repayment plans that's available to borrowers. So keep your ears out for SAVE. I forget the acronym offhand, but it's a new income-driven repayment plan that actually limits the amount of interest that can accrue on your loan if you qualify. So the point here is that interest is a big deal, and some of our in the loan programs and some of our repayment plans are designed to help keep interest rates low, but oftentimes they're anywhere between 4% and 6%.
Thanks for that call, Lynn. Alan is with us now in Rhinelander. Alan, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What'd you want to bring up?
Well, I hate to be sort of a curmudgeon on this issue, but, you know, I've been living and breathing this problem for many years with my own student loans, where $35,000 in original loans exploded because my loans were thrown into default, despite my best efforts to keep them in good stead. And, you know, what I learned is that this entire crisis really hinges on the fact that bankruptcy protections and statutes of limitations and other fundamental consumer protections that exist for all other loans have been stripped uniquely from student loans. And, you know, these income-driven repayment programs, I'm sorry, but they are just a cruel joke. We've seen four of them since 1995, and the cumulative success rate for these income-driven repayment plans is less than 10%. In fact, it's less than 5%. And so, you know, when you take the founding fathers called for uniform bankruptcy laws, by the way, in the Constitution, the head of the power to declare war and raise an army. And this has been taken away uniquely from student loans. And I just wanted to say that. But my question is, did the Supreme Court justices on either side say anything in the opinions about this very glaring, obvious injustice with these loans?
Alan, I gotcha. Nick, bankruptcy and student loans.
I'm nodding my head all along. I think those are all very fair points and well stated. Here is one of the sort of counter arguments to this. I'm not defending the bankruptcy laws and I don't know enough about them, but unlike most other consumer debt, there isn't collateral with a student loan. So you can't take somebody's education away from them, but you could take their boat or their car or some, or their house, you know, the bank could. So that's part of why bankruptcy is not part of the consumer protection portfolio or suite for student loan borrowers. It should be. It absolutely should be. But that's some of the rationale for why it's not. And you know, the banking industry has lobbied very hard to make sure that stays the case. Now, on the other hand of this, I don't know in this particular case with the Supreme Court whether bankruptcy came up. I have not looked specifically for that, but there is an argument that the conservative justices bought and it basically said that the loan companies would be harmed by this cancellation. And the loan, one specific loan company in the state of Missouri, the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority, is the one that the Supreme Court said had standing. They could say that, yes, this organization, this loan company was harmed, would be harmed by debt cancellation. Therefore, we are willing to hear the merits of this case. And the liberal justices disagreed with that completely. They said that this loan company did not have standing. So it's fascinating. I think the caller's questions get right at the heart of who has influence in policymaking. And that's no different in the student loan space.
Alan, thanks for that call. We're talking to Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis, director of the Student Success Through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison, looking at the U.S. Supreme Court's recent rejection of President Biden's student loan debt forgiveness plan and what it means for borrowers. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Are we talking about you? Are you worried about this decision and how it's going to affect your plans? Are you now having to repay these loans where you thought, well, you didn't have to? And what are your questions? What's your reaction to this decision? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Right now, we're picking up our talk with education finance expert Nick Hillman about student loan debt after the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling against President Biden's debt relief plan. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Jimmy is with us in Valley Junction. Jimmy, hi. Do we still have you, Jimmy? All right. No, Jimmy. We'll go to Liz in Lyons. Liz, hi.
Hi. I just have a cautionary tale. My mother recently retired and discovered that she owed $2,000 over 40 years ago in student loan debt, and they did take it from her Social Security, and so now she is behind.
Liz, so she hadn't known she still owed that student loan debt? Did I have that right?
She did not know that.
Interesting. Liz, thanks a lot for that call. Nick, is this something that's common where people might lose track of their student loan debt through the, in this case, decades?
Yes. And there's a program in the U.S. Department of Treasury called the Treasury Offset Program, where the Department of Treasury will garnish wages and they'll get that money one way or another through their Treasury Offset Program. And it is a mechanism that I would not be surprised happens when the repayment pause ends and more people start to get behind on their loans.
Thanks for that call, Liz. Sorry about that for your mom. Pat is with us now in Galena, Illinois. Pat, hi.
Hello. I had to pull over on the side of the road because this issue is just very important to me. I am 69 years old, retired, and I am still paying on my daughters, both of them, their student loan for $80,000. With interest, we are now over $180,000. I've called them over and over again trying to, you know, are we on, you know, the income-driven loans and everything, trying to figure out how to manipulate this. But the bottom line is since it's in my name, when I die, I tell my kids the loans will go away. And that's exactly what Fed Loan said as well.
Pat, thanks a lot for the call. Nick, are there resources out there for someone in Pat and her family's position? They've got that massive student loan debt not going away anytime soon and who don't want to just wait until they die for it to go away?
I mean, it's true. This is the kind of harm, this kind of downside that student loans do have. And they have a real effect and overhang on people's lives. And your student loan servicer is, for better or worse, the main entity that can help you figure out what repayment options are best in your situation. There isn't a lot more help out there than that. Sometimes you might have a federal student loan ombudsman in the state or even federally. And there's some consumer advocacy groups that might be able to help. But by and large, the loan servicers can help navigate those options. And that's really what we have is that.
Pat, thanks for the call. Good luck. Nick, let's talk about, at the outset, how we rack up so much student loan debt. First of all, systemically, and we've talked about this over the years, have we figured out ways to keep the costs of higher education under control so that you don't need these massive debts to get the education that you're hoping is going to boost your career?
Yes and no. The yes side of this is actually student tuition bills have held pretty steady nationwide over the past decade, not just in Wisconsin, but the tuition rates haven't increased at the same rate that they used to increase. And so that's helped keep a lid on some of the student loan inflation that we've seen over time. And actually, borrowers have they're taking out less money today than they did a few years ago. And so there's some things happening on the margins that say, maybe debt isn't going to keep, running as high as it has been for years. On the other hand, higher education is an expensive enterprise, and it's not just that tuition bill. It's oftentimes those non-tuition expenses, the cost of living, paying for childcare, paying for housing, transportation, and so forth in order to go to school in the first place. These are the things that you can borrow student loans to pay for, and these are the things that can really get people into debt. And so it's really a catch-22 in many ways. We want people to invest in themselves, but then on the back end, we make it very difficult for that debt to ever go away. Sometimes it takes 20, 25 years or a lifetime.
You mentioned tuition here in Wisconsin. Let's stay in Wisconsin. Can you paint us a picture of, what our student debts look like here in the state?
Well, the average student loan debt in Wisconsin is around $30,000, and that's a lot of money. But averages kind of do a funky thing. They get skewed by people who have really, really big debts. So in Wisconsin, we've got, I don't remember exactly offhand, it's about 10% of borrowers, I'd say, have a really big amount of student loan debt. And then you have in the middle, around $20,000, where most people are. And then the low end, you have a lot of people who have less than $10,000 in student loan debt. So for example, canceling $10,000 in student loan debt would affect a whole lot of people. And sometimes if we just look at the averages, we might not catch that. We might not see that. So the median, the person sort of, if you line 100 people up, the one right in the middle, the median in Wisconsin would have about $20,000 in student loan debt. So I've just thrown a whole bunch of numbers at you, but I'd say, around the ballpark of $20,000 to $30,000 is kind of on par with national averages, a little bit lower than national averages in Wisconsin.
I want to bring things back around to a group you've mentioned a couple times now, the people who maybe did some college, didn't complete for one reason or another. As you said, life might get in the way, but they've racked up some student loan debt. They don't have the degree that might give them a bump in their salaries. Do you see policy things that could help people in that category?
One of these new repayment plans I mentioned earlier, and I'm still learning more about it, but so keep your eyes on this SAVE program. Part of the design is that if you're in this repayment program, you qualify and stay in it. Now, there are some big administrative hurdles to doing so, but if you're able to do this over 10 years, you'll start to get loans canceled. Now, that's more generous than some of the current repayment plans that oftentimes don't cancel debts until about 20 years later. So that's one thing to keep your eye on. If you work with a nonprofit organization or a governmental agency, you could be eligible for public service loan forgiveness, where if you have 10 years of employment in the public sector or nonprofit sector, you could also get forgiveness. So those are a couple of things to kind of keep on the radar in terms of benefits that maybe folks don't know enough about, but you certainly have to file paperwork, go through administrative processes and burdens to get those benefits.
And briefly, Nick, just our last minute, we heard President Biden foreshadow he's going to try something else. We don't know what that something else is. What are you watching for next in the student loan debt forgiveness story?
You might hear a thing called negotiated rulemaking. That's a process that the federal government goes through when they make changes to the student financial aid programs. And so the proposal that President Biden put out there would have to go through negotiated rulemaking, which brings a lot of people to the table, a lot of interests to the table that could either strengthen or really weaken the cancellation plans as they are. So keep your eyes out for negotiated rulemaking that'll take place over the next several months. And then at the end of that process, we'll have a plan for what happens next.
Nick, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
My pleasure, Rob. Thanks for the invitation.
That's Nick Hillman, professor in the Department of Educational Leadership and Policy Analysis and director of the Student Success Through Applied Research Lab at UW-Madison. He joined us for a conversation about the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling against President Biden's student loan forgiveness plan. Still time for you to share your reactions, your concerns, maybe your own stories. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Wisconsin faces a lot of challenges when it comes to water quality, and rural parts of the state, they're no exception. Check out problems with water around Wisconsin and join in with what you're seeing in your own community. Are you worried about the water where you live? That conversation tomorrow morning at 7:30 here on the Ideas Network.